KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Coming up later this morning, Calgary residents try to recover from record flooding and the stock market tries to interpret Ben Bernanke's next move at the Federal Reserve. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court today released two landmark decisions on same-sex marriage. And joining me to explain a bit what happened, Marcia Coyle. She's chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. She's covered the Supreme Court for 25 years, and she's a regular contributor to the PBS NewsHour. Her new book is called The Roberts Court. Marcia Coyle, thanks for joining us. And I'm asking you to simplify something very complicated, but let's start with the first decision on the Defense of Marriage Act, the highlights, if you will.
Okay. The court had to deal with really two issues in the challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act. And that challenge involved Section 3 of the Act, which defined marriages between a man and a woman for all federal purposes. And that law really affected the operation of more than 1,000 federal laws. The first issue the court had to confront was whether it could actually decide the challenge. It had the peculiar situation where the United States had decided that the law was unconstitutional, and so it agreed with a lower court ruling that the law was unconstitutional. So there didn't seem to be anybody who was really objecting to the law who was a main party to the case. And the court found that it could decide the merits of the law, that there was a continuing injury here to Edith Windsor, who brought the challenge, in that she has to pay over $300,000 in a federal estate tax. So there was an injury to the federal government if it had to pay that. So the court decided it could reach the merits. When it reached the merits, the opinion, the decision was divided 5-4. It was written by Justice Kennedy, and his opinion throughout stressed that states, from the beginning of the nation, of the creation of our nation, have had the authority to define marriage. And here the state of New York, which is the home of Edith Windsor, had given gay couples the right to marry. The federal law, DOMA, he said, interfered with that state's authority in this area, and it actually created a second-class marriage for gay couples who are legally married. Right now, there are 12 states in the District of Columbia that legalize it. So he said that the law's purpose and intent was to basically injure gay couples, and that ran up against the equal protection and due process guarantees in the Fifth Amendment.
So does this ruling then applies specifically to the states in the District of Columbia, where, including Washington State, I must say, that right, do recognize same-sex marriages as legal marriages?
Absolutely. Justice Kennedy explicitly said at the end of his decision that the opinion is confined to those states that have recognized same-sex marriages. There were dissents. Justice Scalia, for 10 minutes, read a summary of his dissent, an impassioned dissent from the bench. He disagreed that the court could actually reach the merits, and he disagreed with what Justice Kennedy ultimately held about the merits of the Defense of Marriage Act. He said that the opinion has armed challengers to states that define marriage traditionally with more firepower to try to bring down those laws. And he also felt that the court had cut off a debate that was underway in the country, and that was a disservice to both sides of the marriage issue.
Hmm. Now, the second decision that was handed down on California's Proposition 8, it seems on the face of it to be a little bit more based on a legal technicality. And maybe you can explain
that. Absolutely, yes. You're right, Marcy. The court was asked by the proponents of Proposition 8 that banned same-sex marriage whether the state of California could define marriage as only between a man and a woman. But the case, even like DOMA, had a problem, a procedural problem with it. And that was, one, the officials of California, state officials, had declined to defend Proposition 8. And when a federal trial court had struck down Proposition 8, state officials did not bring an appeal of that decision. The group that did were the original proponents of Proposition 8, the Ballot Initiative Committee. So the question for the court, before it could even consider whether California could enact Prop 8, was whether that ballot initiative committee had what we call standing, the right to actually appeal the district court's decision. And Chief Justice Roberts wrote the decision today, again, a 5-4 decision, in which he said that they did not have standing to appeal the case. Standing in federal courts means that you have to have a particularized injury that the federal court can remedy. The Ballot Initiative Committee, he said, its role was done when Proposition 8 was enacted by California voters, so it could not bring the appeal.
So what does that mean for Proposition 8? Is it legal?
Okay. Here's what happens now. Since there was no one to bring the appeal, the Ninth Circuit's ruling that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional, the court said today, is vacated. It's thrown out. It's gone. But what's left in place is the trial court's decision and injunction, statewide injunction, against the enforcement of Proposition 8. And we already know that state officials are not going to enforce Proposition 8. So it now seems very likely that gay couples will be able to marry in California.
Does this ruling have any impact on the states that do not recognize same-sex marriage? Or is it only confined to California?
It's only confined to California.
Well, Marcia Quayle, thank you for the ABCs, the plain speak of the Supreme Court decisions. Quite a brouhaha.
You're welcome.
Great.
It was a fascinating morning in the courtroom, and the courtroom was packed, and outside the courtroom was a large crowd waiting for these decisions.
We appreciate you taking time to explain them to us, and we'll be following these decisions both locally and nationally throughout the day. Marcia Quayle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal. She's covered the Supreme Court for 25 years. Her new book is called The Roberts Court. We turn now to Joe Backholm. He is Executive Director of the Family Policy Institute of Washington State. And Joe Backholm, what's your reaction to today's Supreme Court rulings?
Well, I think in both cases, people who are who are supportive of the rule of law and the separation of powers that our constitutional system set up should be concerned. In both cases, in one case with the DOMA case, the Supreme Court did what is fairly unprecedented in saying now that states have the power to dictate to the federal government what their definition of certain terms is. And, of course, that's going to be a patchwork of results now because most states have a natural definition of marriage. And so theoretically, you'll have a tax liability in one state that you wouldn't have in another state because of a disjointed view of, of what marriage is under federal law. And with the Prop 8 case, What happened is now that the Supreme Court has effectively said because the state of California, the elected officials there are refusing to defend the law as passed by the voters, that basically an official in a state who disagrees with a law passed constitutionally by that state can basically make it null and void if he has a personal disagreement with it, because he's the only one withstanding to defend it, and if he refuses to do so, then it has no defense. And so in both cases, kind of our system, our separation of power system, is, I think, significantly undermined today.
Some opponents of same-sex marriage nationwide were quoted on various social media after the ruling, say, saying that despite the fact that these court decisions were issued from the highest court in the land, that this doesn't end their opposition to same-sex marriage nor their fight against it in states where it is still not legal. It is legal in Washington State, so this is where you live. But what are you hearing from maybe colleagues around the country?
Well, I think that's true. I think that those of us who support marriage that recognizes the unique value of a relationship that provides a child a mother and father, for us, that debate is not over, and regardless of what the outcome would was today, that was going to be the case. And I think it's also important to highlight what the court did not say in this, because the plaintiffs did ask the Supreme Court to find a constitutional right to marry anyone that you want. And that is a critical point in kind of the political debate going on here, where they talk about, you know, freedom to marry and equality and those concepts that kind of try to put sexual orientation on par with race and gender and things like that. And the Supreme Court explicitly, and again, and this is consistent with a lot of precedent on this issue, declined to do so. And in doing so, they left this up to the states, where the states can continue to have the debate about whether every relationship is the same regardless of the gender of the people involved. And so I do agree with you and with many people around the country that, that debate is going to continue, and it should continue. And to some extent, it has been left in the political process. But what's concerning is that while they have allowed the states to continue the debate, the Supreme Court has said that our elected officials in Washington, D.C. no longer have the power to engage in that debate. And for the purpose of federal law, it's unconstitutional to say that a relationship that provides a child, a mother and father, is a unique relationship. And so it's kind of inconsistent. And it certainly has no constitutional support, but they created a standard that before, 7 o'clock a.m. West Coast time today never existed in the history of American jurisprudence, called a reasonable consideration standard, because under all of the other evaluations under the 14th Amendment, they couldn't have come up with a justification for saying why the federal government did not have the authority to define marriage this way. So they created a new standard that allowed them to reach the result that they wanted. And that's what activists do. That's not what people who interpret law do.
So what you're saying is that this is an activist Supreme Court?
Well, there's no question, because, I mean, the idea that the federal government does not have the power to define marriage for itself is a completely and entirely new idea. Any suggestion that has previously existed in the Constitution is fictional. So, yes, they created a standard that did not previously exist to allow them to reach that conclusion. So that's not interpreting law, that's making law.
Let me just flip it for Washington State a second. The citizens of this state have voted to give same-sex couples the right to legally marry. So if those marriages are legally recognized in the state, shouldn't those couples get the same tax benefits and other recognized federal rights that heterosexually married couples get?
Well, that is a policy discussion that people can, and I don't know many people who are frankly opposed to inheritance rights and tax rights and all those things. What's at issue here in the larger debate is what is the definition of marriage, and underscoring that, what is the purpose of marriage? And it's unfortunate that the Supreme Court actually took up the policy question that you've raised, because that's not their job. Their job is to determine what the law actually says. And that question is perfectly and appropriately asked in Congress and in our legislative arenas, and they should have those questions. They should answer that question about, should every relationship have the same recognition as we currently give marriage? And, as to the plaintiffs in the DOMA case, where there were two women, and one, they had a tax liability because their marriage was not recognized under federal law. Why should the result of that, why should that tax liability happen if these were two sisters who shared a lifelong relationship and one left their estate to their surviving sister? Why should the result of that be different if they were not involved in a sexual relationship? That doesn't seem equitable either for people who might find themselves in that situation. But those are policy questions that really policymakers need to be answering. And to suggest that there is a definitive answer to that question hidden somewhere in the Constitution that prohibits our elected officials in Washington, D.C., from deciding that marriage is a relationship between a man and a woman is something that you just have to be creative and make up because you want to.
Joe Backholm, Executive Director of the Family Policy Institute of Washington, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A couple of weeks back, writer and gay rights activist Dan Savage was in our studios. He and his husband, Terry, were eagerly awaiting the Supreme Court's ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act at that time. So we thought we'd check in with Dan in the wake of today's decision. I caught up with him driving in a car this morning and asked him what his initial reaction was.
I jumped up to the chair in my kitchen where I'd been sitting at my computer, refreshing my Twitter feed over and over and over again as I listened to the radio, and just cheered and got a little weepy. My husband was upstairs asleep in our bed, and our son was downstairs asleep in his bedroom. And it just felt like such a tremendous relief and to finally have our relationship and our marriage recognized, not just by the city or on the state in which we live, but the federal government as well. Bearing in mind, of course, that this ruling does not apply to the 37 states where same-sex marriage is still illegal and not recognized, that there are couples in those states who will suffer and will suffer discrimination and will be brutally violated, actually, at moments. The most important rights of marriage tend to kick in at the worst moments of life, in hospital rooms, in funeral homes, on deathbeds. And there are couples whose rights will be violated at those moments when they're really down because they live in Mississippi and not Washington State. So we need to remember that this fight isn't over. We won greater rights for the couples who are lucky enough to live in states where marriage is already the law, marriage equality is already the law, but there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of couples who live in states where they are still going to be discriminated against.
And that's a question I have. Do you think that opponents of same-sex marriage may seize on these rulings to make it even harder to expand rights?
Opponents of same-sex marriage will seize on anything, any baloney pony arguments, any shred, any thread, no matter how slender. They will continue to beat up and brutalize and abuse vulnerable same-sex couples who live in states where gay rights are a faint hope. I have no doubt. They will continue to discriminate against couples in those states the same way they continue to discriminate against interracial couples in some states for decades after other states had legalized interracial marriage. And my heart goes out to those couples. And I expect no better from the opponents of same-sex marriage than to continue to brutalize the vulnerable.
Now, finally, last question has to do with the Proposition 8 ruling, which was a little murkier than the DOMA ruling. But some people say that they think that that actually could have more wide-reaching impacts because it really that could be the ruling that really paves the way for the widespread legalization of same-sex marriage.
Yeah, that's the equal protections ruling. And the DOMA ruling itself was pretty broad and lays out a groundwork for future lawsuits, future appeals. This fight isn't over. Some people are talking about these two rulings today as if, game over, we won, we can fold these tents up and go home. And that's not true. And both the DOMA ruling and the Prop 8 ruling really lay out a groundwork for future Supreme Court decisions. Remember that it took ultimately a decision of the Supreme Court to impose interracial marriage on the states that into the 60s and 70s were holdouts, or into the 60s were holdouts for throwing people in jail for marrying someone of the wrong race. We will one day have a ruling that imposes marriage equality and same-sex marriage on the holdout states, and that'll be 20 years in the future. And this is what a lot of us in the marriage equality movement wanted. We thought that sort of a Roe v. Wade 50-state ruling would create such a backlash that it would harm the movement toward marriage equality, that this go-slow federalist approach, one state at a time, for now is the right approach. But you can see, as you said, Marcy, in those rulings, you can see the framework for future lawsuits, future rulings, future Supreme Court decisions, ultimately getting us to a Loving v. Virginia decision for same-sex couples everywhere.
Well, Dan, thanks for talking to me, and congratulations to you and Terry. I know you'll be excited to file your tax return next year.
Oh, no, we are refiling last year's tax return. That is the first thing we're doing. But thank you very much.
Dan Savage is editorial director of The Stranger. He's a gay rights activist and a legally married gay man. I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday.
926. You want to get in shape, but there are so many exercise regimens out there. What's the best exercise routine for you? What sort of exercises should you do? How many minutes a day? How many days a week? Etc., etc. Well, we're going to find out in a minute.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro from NPR News. You can count on KUOW and NPR to provide intelligent reporting that makes you a more knowledgeable person. KUOW's programs take you beyond the headlines to give you a deeper understanding of important issues. Now is the best time to renew your annual KUOW membership or to make a special gift. Please mail your gift in today or give online at KUOW.org. Thank you.
63 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 73 for today's high, with clouds and showers and maybe some thunderstorms this afternoon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 927. Lots of American workers are unhappy with their jobs. Are bad bosses to blame? That's what New York Times columnist Tim Egan says. He'll tell us why he blames the bosses 20 minutes from now.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. A recent New York Times blog post had this astonishing headline, The 4-Minute Workout. Wow, it used to be that we heard if we were moderately active for 30 minutes a day, 5 to 6 days a week, we were doing our part, but now we can get the whole business taken care of in 4 minutes a day. Sounds great, but it does leave us scratching our heads. What should a reasonable person do to get in shape or to remain physically fit? So we put that question now to Priscilla Bell. She's a certified personal trainer. She's been working in the field for more than 30 years, teaching group classes and working with individuals. And first of all, thanks for coming in today.
You're welcome.
And second, what is this minimalist workout that has arisen?
It's a long story, but a dude named Izumi Tabata did a research about 20 years ago, and he put an elite group of athletes, let's just get that out first. And he did, the first group did an hour a day, hour for 5 days a week. So an hour of moderate intensity. The other group did 4 minutes of high intensity training 3 times a week. And that was it. The other one, hour, these guys, 4 minutes. And what he found out was that the cardiovascular benefits were big in the first group and the hour long group, that they definitely increased their cardiovascular capacity. But the second group not only exceeded that, but also developed quite a bit of anaerobic capacity. It increased by about 30%, which means their muscles got stronger as well. And that was not true with the first group. So the 4-minute protocol is 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off for 8 rounds, 4 minutes. The thing about that is that your intensity has to be high, high, high in order to make it work. So it's funny because one of the comments was that these elite athletes were on the floor at the end. So you think about that in the general public, that's going to be hard to do. So when people ask me this question, what's the best workout? My first response is the one you'll do. 85% of the population does not work out, and that has increased by 5% in the last 5 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Despite all the findings that say it's...
Exactly. Well, and here's what I think. I think that they read this and... Even though it's 4 minutes, you know, all of the high intensity, you have to get uncomfortable, is overwhelming. I know it's only 4 minutes, but they're thinking it has to be that hard. So I think that's what deters them. And of course, if you do 4 minutes at moderate intensity, you're not going to get much out of it.
So let's go back. In 2008, the federal government or an arm of the federal government said, 150 minutes of moderate exercise every week. And what they meant was, I think, like 30 minutes 5 days a week.
Sure.
And I guess let me start with the definition. What is moderate exercise?
Well, moderate is, if you're talking heart rate, about 60 to 70% of your maximum heart rate, which is very loose.
Is that walking?
Yes. It'd be walking or pedaling your bike at a rate that isn't, you know, you're not too uncomfortable, but you are pedaling because you're coasting, of course. So more than a Sunday ride. See, the thing about walking is they've also discovered, which was really big in the 90s, right? Walk, walk, walk.
Mm-hmm.
They've discovered that it didn't do anything for women's bone density.
Walking
there
doesn't.
No, because it was actually the same as sedentary women. So the impact wasn't there. And impact is what makes the muscles pull away from the bone, makes them stronger. So this, I think what happened was they were looking at this overall picture, plus the obesity rate increased. So now we have two things. We have So moderate exercise wasn't burning the fat, they thought. So I think when they started to look at this, they were thinking, well, that's true. See, and let's go back. If 85% don't work out, but they'll do moderate exercise, the benefits are huge. Fat loss isn't one of them, but the benefits are huge.
So if you do nothing, walking a half hour a day is better than sitting on your couch.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
that's,
anything that gets you moving.
So that's like the gateway drug.
That's exactly right.
Gateway
exactly
exercise. Right. Let me talk about the weight-bearing exercise, because for women my age,
yes,
women of a certain age, we're taught that or told that,
yes,
we need to do a certain amount of weight-bearing exercise. And this is,
yes,
to help stave off osteoporosis, right?
Exactly.
Right? So what is weight-bearing? Is that like lifting weights?
Yeah, it is lifting weights, but there are specific ones, squatting. And again, it has to be uncomfortable. I think that's the key word. Generally, we don't want to get uncomfortable. We've had everything at our fingertips. So when you tell somebody they need to get uncomfortable, they don't like it. So when you're squatting, and that's hard, let's say we are talking about older women, knees are,
mm-hmm,
an issue.
It does hurt.
So yeah, it hurts. So, and I'm not a particular fan of the squat, and people out there are going to go, but I've never found it to particularly help people, especially because their knees, and they don't do it correctly. So impact, and that one of the protocols is if you do 20 little jump squats twice a week, that will stave off osteoporosis. So the impact of coming down, and most people can actually do a little hop, and that's all. It's just the impact of coming down.
And that separates the muscle from your bone?
Yeah. What it does is when it is the impact will pull the muscle away from the bone. And so then the bones will get stronger. The impact alone will have to make the bone stronger, because if it's not strong enough to take that.
So is that on top of the 150 minutes of moderate,
yeah,
exercise? I mean, how do we parse it out?
Yes. Well, yes, it is part of that. Because the 150 minutes of exercise is the moderate intensity. See, now we refer to that, the walking and the stair taking, as non-exercise activity, and it is extremely important in maintaining your weight. When it comes to losing body fat, then we get, and that's most people's goal. I got to say, honestly, I always ask my clients, what is your goal? And because it might not be, aesthetic, is you have to have the higher intensity. That's what burns fat. And one of the reasons it does is called post-exercise oxygen consumption, or EPOC. And that means for the next 24 to 48 hours, you're burning a higher rate. So now you're burning fat for the next 24 hours. So if it's high enough intensity, the benefits are huge. And yes, my workouts alone are 30 minutes. I never do more than 30, but I am completely out of breath during my intervals. But I don't believe in taking an hour and a half in the gym. We don't have time for one, but you can't. It doesn't get you the benefits of 30 minutes.
We're talking with Priscilla Bell, and she's a certified personal trainer. And this conversation started with the sort of confusing headlines that come up about, get it all done in 4 minutes. Oh, no, you've got to work out 6 days a week for X amount of time. Rebecca emails, there are studies that talk about 10,000 steps per day, and a study,
right,
that movement throughout the day,
right,
is the very best. Like, I've heard that,
right,
if you just stand up at your desk for,
right,
a while, that's better than sitting.
Oh, it's absolutely better. And again, that's filed under the headline non-exercise activity. But let's go back to 85% of the population doesn't work out. So standing at their desk is going to be an increase in activity. Absolutely. Standing is actually, if you've ever tried to stand without moving with both feet on the ground, it is very challenging. You do it for a couple minutes and you want to move around. Mm-hmm. So now we've added movement to your day, where people sit for 9 hours a day, they drive home in their car, they go home and sit on the couch, they get up and do it again. So any activity, and that's why I promote, is any activity is great. Vacuuming your house, anything.
Gardening. There's lots of things that I've read about.
Yeah.
You talked about your 30 minutes every day. One thing that I've heard is that at a certain point in time, I exercise a lot, probably more than a normal person.
Right.
And I've heard that if I'm doing the same thing consistently, my body's going to adapt to it and I have to change it all up.
Yes. That's the other. I know. That's the other. There's so many parts of this.
There are. It's very confusing.
Well, and that's a big concern. And that's when a personal trainer, even for a few sessions, comes into play is really beneficial. I mean, not just to promote me and the rest of the personal trainers, but what our job is, and I love research, and I go in and research everything. So I am excited to develop programs for people. And often I'll, you know, they'll come in and I'll design a program saying, I want you to do this for 6 weeks and then come back to me and we'll do another program. If the person's committed, they're going to do that. They used to think it took 3 months to adapt to a program. It now takes about 6 weeks. So use the story of the woman that goes into the gym and gets on the elliptical. Let's use the elliptical 3 days a week and lose a couple pounds. Now she's a little frustrated, so she goes to 5 days a week, 45 minutes, reading Cosmo, whatever she does. She might lose another couple pounds. In a month, nothing's happened, and she's super frustrated. Now she quits the gym. So if she can get the information about upping the intensity, even on the elliptical, although if you chose a cardio machine in the gym, the elliptical would be the worst.
Really? Why?
Yes, because there's no impact involved, and it helps you. And the readout says you're working harder than you think you are. So you read that. The machine doesn't know how much muscle you have or any of that stuff. So the readout tells you burn 350 calories an hour. You probably burned about 200. As you work and as you get stronger, it drops. And so that's the thing. Adapt. It's adapting.
So that's working out for losing weight, perhaps.
Right.
What about if you are training in a sport for some sort of goal, race or whatever?
Right.
You don't, and I'm speaking from my own personal experience, you have to keep doing that particular sport.
Yes.
So how do you mix it up?
Right. So that's you have to do the sport you're going to compete in. Absolutely, hands down. You cannot train for a marathon and just ride your bike beforehand. So let's just talk marathon or half marathon or 5K. Now their recommendation is to do two interval trainings a week and two steady state runs. What happens with your interval training is you go hard and recover. So you're going to sprint between two telephone poles and then walk or relax. What happens when you get to the race is your body recognizes that activity as easier. So it's like, oh, phew, she's not doing that. So now I can cruise. So now you're going faster without knowing it because your body's adapted to a higher rate of intensity. So it recognizes it as a little bit easier and you go faster longer. So now you used to say, this was a long time ago, but in the 80s, they used to say, you know, 5 days a week, run, do two longest runs, do a short run, do a race pace run. But there was no intervals in there. And that was just the big thing about keeping it low impact. That was the big thing in the 90s.
But you're saying we actually need, especially women need to.
You do. And there are many ways you can do it without hurting the knees. I mean, the knees is a big thing. And that's the little jumps. And, you know, squatting, you can go down a certain degree. But again, it has to be overloaded.
What about walking stairs instead of squatting? Does that count?
Walking stairs are great. Again, it bothers some people's knees. But walking stairs is amazing. And it's one of the granddaddies of intensity training. You go up, you get out of breath, you come down, recover. Up, out of breath, down, recover.
We got a lot of staircases out there.
Exactly.
Arwen emails, what about workout videos? How often, if you use one, should you switch it up? She says, I'm talking about the most high-selling workout video of all time, the 30-day shred.
The 30-day shred. So again, it depends on how intense you feel you're doing. On a scale of 1 to 10, I tell people, are you running for your life hard or is it a little bit? Yes. And if it is a little bit below that, it should be just a little bit below that. I've got to tell you and be 100% honest that if you're at a moderate intensity, and that's usually you can say a sentence to a neighbor or to your kid if you're at home, or are you talking like this? And if you're talking like that, you can say a couple words, then you're at the correct intensity. So that's perceived exertion as opposed to taking the heart rate and stopping, which is, again, what we did in the 80s. If you're doing that three times a week is plenty. But if you're at the moderate intensity, now we're talking about having to do more and maybe not getting the same benefits.
So now I leave the world of like sports training, right. my world. Sure. What if you are that person who hasn't even thought about the 30-minute walk every day? Right. Where do we start?
Well, we start initially with parking further away. That's what we initially start with. So now at the mall, you're not trying to find the closest spot. You're crossing across the mall. So let's say you're really deconditioned. So now you're walking more than you did yesterday and then back. And then you start moving it further, walking to a friend's house. I mean, I read someplace you should walk. If whatever business is within a mile of your house, you should. And that's only carbon. That's carbon footprint as well.
Right.
But just try to get there and come back. Go get your groceries in a little bag and walk back with them on your back. Those kinds of things. Little steps. But first one is parking further away from wherever you're going.
So really the first step might be just stand up at your desk.
Exactly.
And then take the first step and then go to a personal trainer who's going to lay it out for you.
Right. Well, and then you can also, we have our phones everywhere. You can set an alert on your phone for, say, let's just start. You know, easily, and once an hour. So once an hour, you're going to get up and cruise around the office, you know, and you don't have to bother anybody, but cruise around the office a couple times, maybe go down the stairs and up the stairs on your floor, and then go back to your desk. Now, again, we've gotten you out of chair, because I know how it is. I'm rarely at a computer. I never have been. But when I go in to do research, I look up and it's been 2 hours. I mean, we get completely blinders on. And I understand that. So I can't imagine when you have this massive project that's due next week that you would be there 4 hours. So getting out of the chair, it clears your mind. It's great for mood regulation, better sleep, you know, clear your eyes, those kinds of things. And that's how you start. And now you've entered the top 15%.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, I know.
All right. Well, so you guys all feel better. Put your coffee cups down, stand up, right. walk around, and then sit back down. Priscilla Bell, thank you so much for starting people off.
You're welcome.
Priscilla Bell, certified fitness trainer. She's been working with groups. She works with individuals. And she's here with us sharing her knowledge.
Yes, thank you.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:43. Unhappy workers? Blame the bosses. New York Times columnist Tim Egan tells us why in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Dr. Dave was a kind of savior, removing gang and prison tattoos from patients' hands, neck, and face for free. But then his laser broke.
Duck, 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 duck. That's how it normally sounds when you use a laser. Mm-hmm. And then when it stops, it goes... That's it. So it's not really good for radio.
But the rest of the story is, I promise. That's the story. Please join me.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. It's on HD radio and it's online at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Delta Dental, with a wide provider network that includes nearly 90% of Washington State dentists. More information and a list of participating dentists are available at deltadentalwa.com.
63 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for showers through the day, possibly some thunder later, and an afternoon high of 73. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:44. There's been some sudden and incredibly destructive flooding lately up in Alberta, Canada. Vaughn Palmer with the Vancouver Sun brings us that and more news from Canada in 25 minutes.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Last week, the folks at Gallup released a poll that found 7 out of every 10 workers in America is, in their words, disengaged from their jobs. That could mean they hate their workplace, or maybe they just check out mentally as soon as they arrive at the office, the factory, wherever they work. New York Times columnist Tim Egan took a stab at explaining the reason for this last week, and he joins me now to talk about that. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Marcy. How are you? I'm sorry I couldn't walk to the studio and get some exercise in at the same time.
I think you live further than a mile away, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Great to be here.
The Gallup survey was a follow-up to one done a couple of years back. What did researchers find out this time around?
Well, what's interesting is they do this rather exhaustive survey covering a 2-year period, and the one that covered the depths of the recession 2008 through 2010. You know, you can understand those findings, which found that about 70% of all workers either don't like their jobs or are actively disengaged, which means they basically hate their jobs and are almost sabotaging them. What was surprising, one of several surprises, was the second survey they did covering the next two-year period with a recovering economy, a time when, you know, people's jobs are a little more secure, perhaps you're getting some of your benefits back, and it found the same level of sort of active disengagement. People, 7 in 10 people, don't like their jobs, or as I said, there's a minor cohort that are sabotaging. They said they're disengaged to the point where they're costing these companies $550 billion a year in lost economic activity. So it says that there's something at work here far more than just pay and benefits.
And what Gallup found to be the overruling root cause was a little bit surprising. It wasn't
very
that we didn't get paid enough.
It wasn't benefits. It wasn't pay. It wasn't hours. It was bosses. People, overwhelmingly, that is the disengaged, which, again, is 70% of all workers, all people who have jobs, said it's a boss that they blame. They don't feel like they have a mission. They don't feel like their opinion counts. Among those people who were, quote, actively disengaged, almost 60% of them said they were completely ignored at work. No one ever asked them their opinion. They don't know what their mission, their cause is. So it was, and then Gallup went on to parse this further and said that these, as the Gallup CEO called them, bosses from hell, are the causes of why they're losing all this money. So, I mean, it seems a rather simple thing on the face of it. If bosses would just engage the people below them a little more, perhaps a lot of this discontent would go away.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because you wrote about your fast food boss. Yeah. I'm not sure which thing, but that wasn't the major sector that was disengaged. It wasn't blue collar workers.
That was the other big surprise, Marcy, in the survey, was that it wasn't the low end of the pay and educational scale that were most upset. The people who were most upset, most out of it, the people who admit to having mentally checked out the most in the survey were those with college graduates and baby boomers. So, you know, the millennials who, you know, the sort of ongoing theme of them is how hard it is to find a good job. Since we have, you know, 10 million people out of work and another 11 million people who are still looking for more work, they would love to have that level of disengagement. So it's the people who've been in a job for a while and are more educated, that is boomers, who are most upset over this.
And I'm sure the millennials would say, well, we'll take that job.
Yeah, they would happily say it. Now, one interesting thing on the millennials, too, they're the ones, and this is sort of a defining hallmark of their generation, too. We've heard this a lot. They're the ones who are saying they're most likely to leave a job in 12 months if something good comes up.
So, Tim Egan, I know that Gallup's job is to poll, but did the organization propose any potential solutions?
Yes, they did. It was interesting because they don't, this is a rather exhaustive survey, not one of their usual polls where they just put out, you know, a 3-page summary. I read a 60-page plus survey, and it was designed to move the ball a little bit, and they went into a fairly, you know, detailed recommendation about what people could do. And again, it comes down to some fairly simple things. The person in the cubicle next to you who may hold a rank of management should talk to you, should tell you what your purpose is. They should ask you your opinion. People wanted to feel like they were a part of something greater, that is their, you know, their workplace itself. So they said, look, even I said in my column sort of jokingly, even if you have to fake it, talk to your subordinates. I mean, ask them, what do you think? And then I was looking at the comments on my column, hundreds of comments. Overwhelmingly, people told their own anecdotes about how they were ignored, how no one ever asked them what their opinion was. And when they were asked, sometimes it would lead to better productivity. I mean, the workplace has become more productive. That's the other interesting thing. The American workers are more productive by far than almost all European workers. But our level of disengagement is higher than anyone else. So again, the recommendation just comes down to, it comes down to a personal thing. Bosses have to try to talk to the people below them and bring them a little more into the greater mission.
Well, it's interesting. I thought also the timing of your Opinionator column and an article that appeared, actually a couple of articles that appeared in the Sunday edition of the Seattle Times that had to do with the gap between CEO pay and average worker pay.
Right, and that's its highest level, of course, even higher than the 100 years ago, which was the end of the Gilded Age, which prompted all these reforms. But, you know, people brought that up, and they brought it up in the context of, they would say things like, oh, we just feel like we're mercenaries, and we feel like everyone is replaceable. Not that they feel replaceable, but the message from their people above them is, we can replace you. So yeah, you have this one kind of macro sentiment going on, or it's not macro sentiment, but macro fact of the gap never being bigger between the CEOs and those who do, as I said, most of the heavy lifting. And you have this other thing, which Gallup found, which is the gulf is also in terms of how they feel about the place. They don't feel like they're part of it.
But Tim, normally you focus on issues out of the Western United States. Why did you decide that this was a thing that you really wanted to write about?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a bit of, I mean, I'm based in the West, but I'm lucky I have this position at the paper where I can comment on anything that sort of catches my fancy. And I've always been struck by this thing. You know, what you do in journalism is you dip into a million lives, and you dip into these lives, and you see these interesting people doing, you know, biological experiments on one level, teaching kids on the other, building skyscrapers here or there, or being a lawyer. But I'm always interested in what's just below the surface of that, too. And this is one of those rare times where we can see what's just below the surface. We journalists are really good at telling, you know, fact A, fact B, a Supreme Court ruling here, but we don't often go beneath and give some really quantitative look at how people really feel. So that's what drew me to this.
Do your bosses talk to you a lot at the New York Times?
I never hear from them. I never see them. I'm kidding. I said to my boss when I sent my piece in, I sent him a note saying, this applies to everyone but you. No, we do have. I mean, I don't know how this is going to sound, but I actually feel at the New York Times very appreciated. And I think there's always been a fairly collegial atmosphere that people do ask you, you know, your view of things because, you know, folks like me, we're out in the country, meaning not in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So they really rely on us to give them feedback one way.
Well, it's interesting because journalism as a profession, is, I mean, there aren't, that we see decreasing jobs all around the country. I'm not sure if it's hit your employer quite yet, but everywhere else in the world, journalists are losing their jobs. And they do sort of hang on to something that they might be dissatisfied with because there really is no option.
Yeah, and it's another discussion, Marcy, you're right. I mean, journalism is one of these fields that has been just shrinking much to the breaking of my heart. Last week, the Oregonian was a very big deal, and 37 people were laid, basically had told to take buyouts and all of that. And it's another question. The interesting thing I've found about journalists is, though they tend to bitch and whine and moan, people do feel that they're part of a greater mission. That is a mission of telling the story of this country and telling this sort of daily narrative, and that keeps a lot of people going, even when they don't get compliments.
Well, I compliment you for joining us, Tim Egan. Tim writes the Opinionator blog. It appears every Friday, right, in the New
Correct.
York Times.
Yeah.
Really appreciate having you talk with us about your column and your thoughts on work.
Great, Marcy. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Weekday on KUOW. And now, the sound of the day. KUOW reporter Ann Dornfeld is in Washington, D.C. today, and she was near the U.S. Supreme Court this morning when the justices handed down their decisions on California's Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act. She recorded that chanting. It's the sound of a huge crowd cheering the lawyers and plaintiffs from the DOMA case as they all walk down the steps of the Supreme Court, and you hear them chanting thank you and USA near the end of that. So that's the cheer. And if you are just waking up this morning, you may not know that the U.S. Supreme Court did rule 5-4 on sort of liberal versus conservative lines that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional in discriminating against people who were legally married in the states where they reside. And I believe we have some more reaction to that.
think this is a historical day, and I think the Supreme Court made an excellent decision in striking down DOMA. It's good to see that our lawmakers can make the right decisions when truly pressed to make really socially conscious decisions.
When legislators for the country, when the national legislators legislate against natural laws, it won't be long before the country has genuine problems where the fabric of our society falls apart. I'm so sorry this has happened.
Those were two very different reactions to the U.S. Supreme Court decision to declare the Defense of Marriage Act, the 1966 law, unconstitutional in that it discriminates against legally married couples in states where same-sex marriage is legal. Proposition 8, California's law that bans same-sex marriage, was remanded back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And in doing so, according to our guest earlier this hour, Marcia Coyle, that means that the law that existed before Proposition 8 took effect on its face will become law, which is that gay marriage will become legal in California unless the California government decides that it's going to enforce Proposition 8, which it has tacitly decided not to do by not defending the law. It's very complicated, and we're going to bring you continuing analysis and reaction to those U.S. Supreme Court decisions throughout the day. Coming up in the next hour on weekday, we're going to be talking with Vaughn Palmer. Canadians had some reaction to President Obama's speech yesterday that pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, would not be built if it was proven to have a significant impact on global climate. And Vaughn tells us, Bernard, that...
Yeah, that was interesting.
Depends what the meaning of significant is, sort of like what is the meaning of is. So Vaughn will have that reaction. We're also going to hear about massive flooding in Calgary. John Talton will be in to talk about the crazy stock markets and what Ben Bernanke has in store for us. And Robert Horton comes in to give us a little cultural fix. We're going to talk about documentary film so we can get a little highbrow this summer.
That's all ahead during the 10 o'clock hour this morning on KOW. And as Marcy just said, we'll be covering the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on DOMA through the day, what it means and what it doesn't mean, and how people are responding. We'll hear President Obama's reaction in the news in a minute here. And if you want to share your thoughts, you can give us a call, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Or go over to our Facebook page, facebook.com/KUOW Public Radio. This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to 17 destinations in the Middle East. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
Next time on The World, acquiring wealth in China means new responsibilities.
You need to know how to behave.
This etiquette coach teaches China's nouveau riche how to keep up appearances.
We have a class on fur, and afterwards, the students go shopping for fur coats.
China's new millionaires learn to mind their manners. That's next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from King County Solid Waste Division, encouraging families to reduce household garbage by one bag a month. Junk mail, pop cans, plastic tubs, and bottles can be recycled. Online pledge at kingcounty.gov/recyclemore.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.